As all good things come in threes, this talk has three parts, or better still, we'll attempt to answer three questions. 1. What is the Holy Face devotion? 2. Why is it a devotion of the Holy Face? 3. Who can see the Holy Face? First, when one mentions or talks about devotions or prayers concerning the Holy Face, the mind focuses on one of four realities. That is, there are four holy faces or holy images of God. 1. Veil of Veronica in Rome, perhaps the most popular. 2. The Shroud of Turin in Italy. 3. The Sudarium Veil in Oviedo, Spain. And 4. The Manapello image in the Abruzzi Mountains, Italy. Each of these images has its own unique and problematic history. Books and documentaries are most numerous on them all, in particular the Shroud. So I do not intend to delve into their own particular characteristics, except to note that they all bear a unique hallmark that will be discussed later. At the outset then, and somewhat in reply to the first question, let it be said that a devotion to the Holy Face is a sacramental. It's not a sacrament. Sacramentals give grace, but in a limited fashion, according to the effort of the devotee. Nor are these sacramental holy faces to be confused with the theology of the Holy Face. Although the two are related, they do remain distinct, just as gloves and a hand go together yet can remain separate. As a devotion, what is common to most of us here is the Holy Face image derived from the Veil of Veronica. It is French in origin and dates back to the Carmelites in the 1800s. One key player in this devotion was Venerable Leo Dupont, who sought to make reparation to God's holy name and countenance. In 1843, he joined forces with Sister Mary of St. Peter from the Carmelite convent in Tours, who sought the faithful to atone for blasphemy against God's holy face. Then, in 1849, when the Veil of Veronica in Rome was exposed for public veneration, some saw on it a particular image of the divine face, distinctly, as if living, which was illumined by a soft light, and the features assumed a death-like hue, with the eyes deep sunken and wore an expression of great pain. That's the image before us. Now, copies of this image were distributed and promoted by Pope Pius IX, who should be a saint. At the time, some were given to St. Mary of Tours, who then passed them on to Leo. The image of such a persecuted and suffering holy face ideally suited his apostolate of reparation and atonement. As a consequence, Leo hung the image in his parlour and lit a lamp in front of it because it was Holy Week, as one would. Little did he know that the image would show for its miraculous character time and again, and that his humble lamp would burn continuously to the end of his days. From the many miracles wrought by the image there, the apostolate fostering devotion to the Holy Face spread, even to this day. In time, Pope Pius XII in 1858 approved the devotion and established the Feast of the Holy Face on Shrove Tuesday. As a consequence, we can affirm that the Church approves of this sacramental devotion. And some doctors of the Church, such as big-time Saint Thérèse of Lisieux, fostered it, along with her parents, who are also saints, throughout their lives. We are, therefore, in good company. Now, having outlined the basics of the French Carmelite devotion of the Holy Face, one should be mindful that there are other authentic devotions of equal standing in the Church. The Catholic Church is universal in origin and nature, and embraces all devotions pertaining to the Holy Countenance of God. What is most illuminating about them is their striking uniformity. Studies of the image on the shroud and the holy face in the image of Manapello show not only a correspondence between them, but, note this, when one is superimposed over the other, there are physiological facial features which are a perfect match. In short, what this reveals is that these images of Jesus are in complete harmony. Be it with the eyes open or closed, they all match, including the blood type AB. So that's interesting. Although they come from different origins and they're different qualities of images, they all structurally are the same face. That's the first question. The second, why is there a devotion to the holy face? The origin of this question is most critical and somewhat clerical. When I mentioned the devotion of the holy face to a fellow priest, I was met with cynicism and snide remarks. He exclaimed, "We have now devotion to the holy blood, the holy face. Why not in the future the holy hands or holy feet or holy side? Where will it stop? The holy toes." "Now, just have devotion to Christ," he said, "or the Lord crucified. Why do we have to itemize the parts of Jesus?" Sounds fair enough. At face value, note the pun, I must agree, it sounds like a plausible scenario and most human. Is it not a weakness in our human nature to select in a reducing manner our own personal exclusive wants or parts, almost at the expense of the whole? We do that. Although I accept the underlying sentiments in the argument and note in reality how common such forms of piety can become, I do categorically reject that any authentic devotion to the holy face is extreme or reductionist in form. Why? Well, for two reasons. Firstly, to worship the face of God is to worship not a part of the person, but the whole person. You see, a leg or an arm, even toes, are members of the body. They are not essential to the existence or presence of the whole person, but the face or head is. One cannot exist without the head, and the face is the appearance of that head. So when one worships the face of God, one is worshipping the actual presence of God. Secondly, it is an ancient belief that we worship the face of God. It is steeped in tradition. Even before the incarnation, when God's Son took upon himself our human nature, the Jews worshipped God's face. There are about 70 Bible passages from the Old Testament that directly refer to the face or countenance of God. What is highly significant about this point is that these are Jewish texts and they did not believe in the incarnation of God. So for them, God is not a bodily person, but a spiritual being. Yet, they still refer to his holy face. One of my favorites is from Numbers that says, "The Lord makes his face shine on you, and he is gracious to you. The Lord lift up his countenance upon you and give you his peace." Or Psalm 27, "Do not hide your face from me. Do not turn your servant away. You have been my help." Great patriarchs in the Old Testament, such as Job, Abraham, Moses, David, all refer to the face of God, the face of the divine spirit, who is faceless as such. In each case, the language of the face of God refers to the presence of God made manifest to our faces. Third question, who can see the holy face? Well, the Jews couldn't. God has no face for him, nor for Muslims. We can because Jesus has a human face that is now in glory. The images we have of him are all pre-resurrection. So Christians alone can worship God's face. True, well, true and false. When I mean false, I mean to say, can you really see the face of God? Can you? And all the above devotions of the face of God, the actual image was not or still cannot be seen. One cannot see any image on the Veil of Veronica today. The Holy Face image we have here was what people saw on one specific occasion. The veil normally bears no recognizable image. Note the shroud. It manifests no image except in the negative of a photo, which was first seen only in 1898. The extraordinary Manopello image on muscle silk can only be seen if the light and angle permit. And lastly, the Sudarium veil in Spain bears no image at all. So it seems that the Holy Face of God, although we have images of it, remains, for the most part, hidden. Yet at times, images have been seen. Is God playing hide and seek? I think not. But I do think that we can learn something from the patriarch Moses, who truly desired to see the face of God. And God said to him, "You cannot see my face, for man cannot see me and live." And the Lord said, "Behold, there is a place by me where you can stand on the rock, and while my glory passes by, I will put you in a cleft of the rock, and I will cover you with my hand until I have passed by. Then when I will take away my hand, you shall see my back, but my face shall not be seen." Interesting, huh? Although this was an Old Testament event, and we now have the risen face of the Lord, I think there remains a germ of truth in this encounter that is worthy of our consideration. The point being that while we live, we cannot normally see God's face. Leaving aside visions and exceptional blessings, the face of God is what occurs, not in this life, but in the next. Heaven is the beatific vision, that is, the viewing of the blessed face of God. There are some realities that transcend this world, not because God can't grant them, but because we're unable to assimilate them. The words of Scripture, "You cannot see my face and live." You see, our senses are limited in this world. We cannot see much at all of the big picture. Take, for example, the nature of light, or the EMS, the electromagnetic spectrum that encompasses all waves of light from X-rays, ultraviolet, radio, and so forth. We can only see a limited, specific field of coloured light. Yet other fields exist that transcend our natural abilities. Well, if there is a natural limit to our sight, why would there not be a supernatural limit to our spiritual sight? And there is. See, we cannot see grace, heaven, angels, nor God's face, but one day. What limits our spiritual sight anyway? I think there are two answers. Firstly, we are not equipped with spiritual sight here, but only limited physical sight. Yeah, our eyes are superb. They are, aren't they? Yes. But they just can't see spiritual realities. They're not meant to. Secondly, even if we had the spiritual capacity, we would still be incapable because we lack in our present state the perfection that pertains to the blessed. This second aspect means that while we are pilgrims or sojourners here, we cannot see yet his face because we are still two-faced. Being two-faced means that we are actually faceless, that is, spiritually faceless. The real matter at hand is that in this life, the imprint of his face cannot be borne on ours. In holy people or the innocent, it comes and goes. It's not able to remain. It's not meant to remain for these reasons. One, whilst here, we're all sinners, and it properly belongs to those who are saints in heaven, the blessed to see God. Two, while we are all, in the language of C.S. Lewis, bent, weakened by original sin in such a way that prevents us from beholding God as he is. That is, we're held back by our predominant fault, self-pity, pride. One good book that explains that is Lewis's book, The Great Divorce. Three, being in that state, we are incapable of fully absorbing his light. With his light comes his presence that is reflected in the face of each of the blessed in heaven. And some reflect him more, thus they glow more, because on earth they loved him more. This Christ-like reflective capacity pertains only to the blessed. and not to us. So, meanwhile, as we await such glory, heaven, we can prepare ourselves well by beholding his face here on earth and praying. O Lord, make your face shine upon us and be gracious to us.